Welcome to Journals of Self-Discovery. Hello, everyone. I'm happy to have Paul Constant as my guest today. Paul, whose real name is Phil, had a deep awakening in 2007, which he describes as the experience of nothingness. But his experience didn't end there. We'll talk about that and more in this interview with Paul Constant. All right. Well, thank you, Phil, for joining me this morning. I appreciate your time with this. And I just wanted to point out to whoever might be listening that they may be more familiar with you under the name Paul Constant, as that's what you often write under and are advertised under on the web. So just to start off, I'm curious if you can explain to folks why you chose to use a pseudonym rather than your actual name.
Ah, it's an interesting question. I think it goes back maybe 10 years ago, maybe not quite that long, where I just felt like with the internet being so easy to see folks and track folks down, I just felt more comfort with me and my family just being a bit more private with it. And I think it also, at that time, I was thinking about finding a different job, and so I didn't want potential employers Googling my name and thinking I was out there on a limb somewhere. So it just felt more comfortable to be private and take up the name Paul Constant. And that was it's an interesting the way it was came about. I think I was exchanging, I was posting something for a TAT forum article, and I told Art Tickner, who at the time was a forum editor, said, I don't really want to put my real name out there. And he's the guy that actually came up with Paul Constant, which I think fits my personality, because I just have this steady state personality that doesn't change a lot. And so therefore, Constant must have been the thing that rang a bell for him as a pseudonym. So as soon as he said it, I said, that's perfect. Let's just go with that. And that's where it took off from there.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, is there a, just to begin at the beginning, is there a point in time that you would say that your spiritual search began?
Yeah, I think in my late teens, I was reading, I started to read some books. I was going to Penn State at the time, a branch campus. And I got into, I think it was Krishnamurti at the time, what I would just call light spiritual reading. And I became very fascinated with it. So I was probably 18, 19 at that time. And at some point, I went to the main campus, which at that time, before the internet, had a huge library of books. And I think my first, what I would call serious book, was Uspensky. I was in an art class, in fact, in my curriculum. So it must have been maybe my third year in college. And the art teacher was talking about waking sleep. And he mentioned Uspensky's In Search of the Miraculous. And he just said it in the middle of the class, if you ever want to read an interesting book, get this. And so I went down after the class was over and said, what's the name of that book and the author? And sure enough, it was there in the library. And I would say that was, I was hooked at that point when I started reading about the potential of spiritual work, and got hooked into one of his students, Uspensky, and read The Fourth Way. And that's also was very, very much in line with my highly intellectual approach at that time to spiritual work. I was all pretty much in my head. So that book really appealed to me. And then I'd say later on, I was perusing books. I think at the time it was B. Dalton and Walden bookstores were popular in malls, and I was in the Pittsburgh area. I opened a book, can't remember which one it was, but at that time, Richard Rose and the Tap Foundation had an approach which included these maybe 3-inch by 3-inch pieces of paper. We used to call them stuffers, that advertised books that that were Richard Rose's books. And I remember reading a short description about the Alvagent papers, and it was on that stuffer. So I had picked up a book, took it home, saw that stuffer in it, and thought, oh, that's intriguing. Interestingly enough, I think I set it aside and lost it. And I remember 6 months or so later, where is that piece of paper? That sounded like a really intriguing book. And I found it, ordered the Alvagent papers, and then that's when things really started to take off from there.
Now, you mentioned Krishnamurti, right?
Yes.
For a college student, why in the world were you drawn to something like that? Why did you pick up that book? What were you looking for?
I remember the book was Think on These Things. I would say I've always been drawn to the mystical side, the magical side of the spiritual approach. And I know if I were to put seekers into two camps, generally there's the camp that is just captivated by the mystery and they're pulled towards the search for reality or search for truth. And then the other camp, which is probably more common, are those that are repulsed by life, so to speak. Just they're suffering, they don't like what they see in life, and so, they're looking for escape from something they don't care for. So I think with Think on These Things, it wasn't heavy stuff. It was just the way he was talking that captivated me. It was just like the mystery behind life. What is the mystery of life? And it just kind of really, it was just like gravity just pulled me right into it.
So you were already attracted to those questions, but hadn't come across any material, or you just randomly came upon this book and were curious about the title?
I think if there was a kind of a mini stage before that book, I was always interested in like the potential magic of the mind. So I would read stuff like table tilting, psychic phenomena. I remember one time I watched a guy bend a key in front of me repeatedly, and I was just absolutely convinced that he was doing it with his mind. I really don't think he was, but I was just totally pulled into the potential qualities of the mind that every day in everyday life we don't use or don't see. So that was a door opener for me. I'm pretty convinced that it was like the psychic phenomena can be a pretty interesting doorway for people into something deeper, and that's definitely what it was for me that led me to that book. And then that book was just like a deeper level to me. It wasn't talking about what all the mundane things you can do with your mind. It was something, there must have been something about the words that really struck my intuition. There's a lot more going on behind life than we're really paying attention to.
Is this at the time that you were interested in the psychic phenomenon and so forth, is this something that your family had an interest in or that your parents first exposed you to? And if not, what did they think about all that?
Well, I was raised a Catholic, up until I think my first Holy Communion, my mom, insisted that I go through the Catholic school and go to church every Sunday. And I remember thinking, even as a child, like some serious questions about what really is God, what's the difference between God and Jesus. And it was a little interesting to me, but it was also extremely boring. And so after like eighth grade in school, my mom pretty much gave up. So she got me to the point where she said, okay, I've given you a deep taste of the Catholic Church, but from here on, you know, I'm not going to drag you to church. And I was so bored with it, I didn't go. So other than that, my family was not interested in anything deeper, except, you know, the basic religious approach. But I think what I would say I'm just really grateful for is my family was very wholesome. My parents, you know, now that I'm 53 years old and I talk to a lot of people and see what's going on around me, I think probably my parents were more unique and just they were, you know, they had it together. They gave me a decent middle class life, kept my nose clean. But I, you know, when it comes to talking with my family, my mom died in 1994. So I was, you know, I was in my early 30s at that point. I never really broached a subject with her. And my dad, to a little bit, he knows kind of what I'm into, but I really don't go into it too deeply because he's just not interested. And I don't want to try to convince him of one thing or another or just explain what I'm doing. So family was not a big part of the encouragement, but certainly gave me great space, you know, great space to explore. And it probably ties into what I said before about I wasn't suffering in life because I had a great childhood. And so it wasn't the suffering that pushed me into the spiritual path. It was more the mystery of it.
Well, let's fast forward then a little bit. You mentioned Richard Rose already, that you came upon him. What would you say was the difference between meeting Rose, encountering Rose, and what you had done up to that point?
I remember reading through all of his books very rapidly. Like within a year, I'd read 5 books. And I remember when I called him, the thing that caught my attention was as soon as I called and mentioned my name, he said, oh, you know, you're so-and-so. And he recognized me. And so that made it kind of special. You know, I was expecting this to be a large organization and a teacher being kind of lofty. So he invited me up to his farm in West Virginia at that point. And the timing, part of why I called was I, you know, basically had said, I feel like I don't know what to do now. You know, I'm really captivated by the books, but it just feels like I need to meet people and do something along these lines. And he had what he called an chautauquas. And specifically in August, it was for people that were interested in his system of teaching. So he called it the August Chautauqua that he would have every year. And that's in contrast to TAPT Foundation meetings, which were more open, more general, not specific to his teachings. So he invited me, like within 2 weeks, he said, we have a meeting coming up in 2 weeks, and it's the August Chautauqua. And when I stepped on the farm, you know, I was very introverted at that time. So this was a huge thing for me to leave my comfort and go on to a group that I didn't know anybody, didn't really feel that comfortable with. But I think to answer your question, what I would say is I felt the impact of sitting there listening to him. It was very, I remember that first time I walked on the farm, and within listening to him for a few hours and walking from the place where we were meeting, the Chautauqua building, down to the farmhouse, it literally felt like I was floating, you know, because I was just so inspired by what I heard. So the books inspired me to some degree, but there was something more palpable to a group setting, and certainly more palpable listening to him directly. It really just inspired me, yeah, to a great degree. Like, I felt it in me.
And what did that inspiration, what sort of action resulted from meeting Rose? How did your life change?
Wow. I think when I met him, I was 21 or 22. And so I was just graduating from college. Didn't know where I was going in life at that point, of course, like most students. So the world was open to me at that point. I remember, I think what he did for me was gave me hope that this was possible for other people. You know, I saw it in him. And looking back, I can see he, compared to some of the many of the teachers you see out there, he was very ordinary. You know, he would joke about being a hillbilly himself, so there was nothing about him that was, well, yeah, it's hard to describe. He was extraordinary in his determination, for one thing, so that showed in me the potential that if I applied myself in a certain direction, that could change my life. And as I said, the world was open, so I chose this this line of thinking, this pursuit at that point, in tandem with my career and whatnot. But this was always super important to me, and it has been for the last 30 some years. Yeah, I think he just showed that it was possible for the ordinary person, that I didn't need to travel across the world overseas to see some guru to pursue this further. That it was something I could do myself.
Well, how would you, let's say in your 20s, can you characterize your life at that time? Were you, standing on your head every morning and taking ice baths, and, you know, what was your life like? You mentioned that you had to go to work, so you had a job throughout that time. Were you just a typical guy most of the time?
I think most people would probably say yes, I was very typical. I wasn't a very open person, so I didn't talk about my spiritual life very much. I was very private. I guess that's carried through with my pseudonym as well. I was very private at that time. So I would say most people would look at me as very ordinary, you know, in my college days and whatnot. My social life just probably was pretty ordinary. Go out to bars and party with people, but not get too carried away with it. So I never been one for extremes. So when you mentioned like standing on your head or doing odd spiritual practices, I don't think I engaged too much in that. But I think my expression of applying the energy would have been, at that time, Rose wasn't too far away, so I would go out between TAP meetings and visit him, work with some of his students who lived on the farm, and I learned a lot. Amazingly, when I first went to see him, I didn't want anything to do with other than the students, because I didn't really think they had anything to offer, and a lot of them became my best friends. And so that was a lesson learned in my 20s, the value of spiritual friendship. I think my practice would have been characterized by introspection. I was constantly watching my mind, and I would pretty much make a commitment to go for a walk every day and just stop all the other stuff in my life and just say, okay, I'm taking a 30-minute or 60-minute break. I'm going to go for a walk and watch my mind and see what I can learn about myself, what makes me tick. So I would say, you know, just continuing to read books, doing a bit of that walking meditation, visiting Rose. And that would have been the early part of the search. It was all take, by the way. You know, I was always seeking to extract as much as I could. So it was in a way a bit selfish in that I was trying to get as much as I could and didn't really at that point see the value of giving back in a way that later proved to be extremely rewarding in this endeavor.
Did you reach a point where you felt like you had plateaued or a point where you just felt like giving up?
I did. I definitely shifted my efforts. So I met Rose in 1985, and then in 1995 he had faded from the scene due to his Alzheimer's and wasn't really accessible anymore. Had been moved into a nursing home. And I remember that was a huge transition because a lot of people were saying the Tat Foundation can't survive without its founder and teacher, main teacher. And a couple of us, you being one, really got our heads together and tried to keep things moving. And things had really dwindled at that point. To some of the meetings had six people in them, which I thought, yeah, you know, that time I was dating Cindy, who would be my wife eventually, but she came to a gathering and said, she didn't tell me until later, but said, this is totally hopeless. You know, you have six people sitting around trying to make this a go at it. So I shifted my efforts at that point to figuring out how to carry this message to other people. But then I would say, there was a huge bump in inspiration where folks started to have realizations, some of Rose's students that I've known a while, and that really gave me hope that this was also possible, that this wasn't, you know, some all about Rose, that now this was accessible to people like me who were students. So I got a nice bump in inspiration, but at some point, I actually concluded this wasn't going to happen for me. So, you know, it felt like I tried everything. It felt like I failed at a bunch of stuff, and it just wasn't. I could see the effect on me, but it didn't feel like I could make a final leap. So, yes, at some point, I totally gave up, and I remember even commenting, well, I'll just shift my efforts into trying to make TAT available and this message available to other people. And that was kind of a way I, in retrospect, kept my head on the problem. It kept it there in my face. Even though I was helping other people and just had given up on myself, it was sort of a constant reminder of the search for truth.
Why didn't... You know, I've known some people who, excuse me, who seemingly, when they give up, they're gone. They're out of there. Their life changes completely. Why didn't that happen with you? Why did you, instead, it sounds like you decided to, well, I'm going to keep working at this, but by helping other people.
You know, people are often on a spiritual path because they want to get to the end of the path and get this huge reward at the end of that path. But I saw the value and the beauty all along the path. I mean, it just, I think I was Well, I know I was hugely grateful at that time, and that gratitude just continued to magnify as I lived my life. But I could see the returns. Not that I was really in it for that. You know, I wasn't in it for, like, to improve myself. At some point, I realized it's a self-improvement project. This wasn't what it was about. But I could see the change in myself. So, and I could see the friendships that have been forged over, you know, all those years. And yeah, it this might be an overstatement, but I think it was fun. You know, I just saw a lot of cool things happen over the years, saw other people realized to great depths. And I just don't think I could ever walk away. I mean, it's just the mystery of reality is just too captivating for me to walk away from it.
You mentioned the message earlier and helping to continue the message of the TAP Foundation. How would you summarize that message?
Well, I think friendship to me is the key, one of the key points in the TAP Foundation. So, and by that I mean, you know, there's a lot of teachers out there who have what I call a hierarchical approach, and meaning they'll say, I have this and you don't, where the friendship approach in the TAP Foundation is more or less it's equalized. I mean, I feel like I could walk into a TAP meeting and see a bunch of people sitting down over a lunch or dinner, and you can't tell the teachers from the people there who are seeking. And so one of the things that I like about it is that those who have found are easily accessible. They are friends. They don't convey this aloofness or loftiness. They don't, to my knowledge, for anybody in TAP, they don't charge a fee. Never have charged a fee for what they're giving, which is, by the way, a very genius principle that Rose instilled. You know, there's a lot of debates about what to charge and whether to charge for teachings, but I can see where money muddles things quite a bit. It doesn't say that if somebody teaches and charges that they're not enlightened. You know, it's not that exclusive, but I do see how it complicates things dramatically when there's steep charges to what's freely accessible to all, essentially. So yeah, that was another principle that I liked about TAP. It was not excluding people that couldn't afford it. And it doesn't, it just doesn't have what I would call like a core dogma. There's nobody saying you must do A, B, C in order to get realized. So it leaves it open to people applying their own energy and their own unique body, mind, makeup, whatever approach resonates with them. And I guess lastly, what's really cool about it nowadays is you have several finders who all came at this from different angles, who all work together pretty well, despite the fact that we had different recommendations, even different approaches, just because of the way we all came into it. So now when we're on the other side, so to speak, we're teaching in a way that feels authentic to each person, and which is great. Then you got a much wider approach for those listening. You know, they can resonate with a certain teacher if it feels right to them, instead of just having to come and listen to one teacher with a pretty, you know, narrow approach, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about finding. That's something that people are always curious about in these interviews. At some point, and perhaps at more than one point, something happened for you, something you did discover something. Can you share a little about that?
Yeah, I think it's a it might be a biased opinion, but I think it's a pretty cool message for people looking for this. And what's cool about it is it happened in stages. And so I think what tends to happen with a lot of seekers, they feel like they're going to apply themselves and then this will change them all at once in a very fundamental way. In a classic example of that might be Ramana Maharshi, where just, there was this huge change at 16 years old, which is, I think, way out there and a very unique finding, a very unique realization. But in my case, as I said to you, in 2000, mid-2000s, I had given up and I was still meditating, and my form of meditation was to sit down and try to keep my mind in a neutral area. In other words, if my thoughts drifted, I would try to come back to what I would call center, just a neutral place of watching. So I knew that I was aware. I knew that was a fundamental quality within myself that could watch my mind, could watch thoughts and feelings, but I couldn't quite figure out where that awareness was. And that was my question: what is the source of my awareness? I remember going out to the TATS community building at the time, which was, a lot of people had invested efforts into that building. And I always say that building was a physical manifestation of friendship because so many people had worked on it over the years. So I went out there to spend a weekend by myself, which just gave me some quiet time to sit. And I actually decided to sit and meditate. And I don't feel like, I feel like this is providence that stepped in at that point. I don't really feel like I made anything happen, but I got very determined to watch my mind. And I saw a lot of things start to happen with the more and more, I almost got angry at the fact that I couldn't keep my mind on center. And I almost saw like this great tension developing in this watching process. And this probably occurred over 30 minutes. I don't know. I sort of lost track of time in it. But this thing ratcheted up to such an intense degree that I felt like this electricity outside of me that flooded in at some point, and everything of me was stripped away. So it was in retrospect a brief death of the mind in which I dissolved into my true nature. And it was what I would call becoming nothingness. So I became fundamentally what I am without the mind, so to speak. Well, it just that's probably the best way of describing it, that it was I emptied myself out into emptiness, nothingness, the one, however you want to call it. I called it an experience of one awareness in retrospect when I wrote something about it. And there were a couple of interesting things that happened after that, which I knew at the time were kind of implanted just to make sure that I understood the depth of this, that I remembered it. And I remember having my head blown off. It was truly a feeling. I hadn't read anything of Douglas Harding, but when he talks about headlessness, it was truly like my head had blown off and I was the universe on top and my body was dropping out of this nothingness. I remember feeling this distinct sense of I am Hollow Man, like I was a hollowed out character. And then at the end of that, I there wasn't any emotion with this. It was just like this whole process, it wasn't a deeply emotional thing. I wasn't sad or anything, but I remember putting my face in my hands and knowing unequivocally that I kept saying over and over, I do not exist. So I knew that that was beyond debate. But the funny thing is, and this is where I say it's kind of a cool experience, because if there are other people out there that have these things happen, they know there's a potential for more to happen. So right after that, my mind said, it basically filled the vacuum of nothingness and came back and said, you know, this isn't authentic. This isn't the end. This isn't what happened to the same thing that happened to some of the other people that were realized in TAP, because I made the mistake of going back to the cabin where I was staying and reading their descriptions of their realizations and saying, no, that didn't happen to me. That didn't happen to me. And the big part of this was the fact that everything I had been looking for, you know, my question was, what is the source of awareness? Was so simple and obvious to me that I said, this can't be it. It was like the awareness was no longer personal, and now it was always present. You know, it wasn't like this kind of it wasn't like the spotlight shining on the mind or thoughts and feelings. It was like it was everywhere. It was in my face. So everything I had been looking for, I was looking out of, so to speak. And that simplicity could not be accepted, because I'd spent 22 years and this was the answer, and it just was almost laughable. But so that was a resting place for a couple of years. I was really, really trying to make sense of it. Where does this thing fit in with what other people have realized? And I talk with other teachers about it. And interestingly enough, none of them ever gave me, I felt like none of them were ever mature enough. I'm talking about teachers outside of TAT. Were mature enough to really put this into context. So a couple of years later, I think it was about 5 years later, I ran into another teacher who was very Shakti oriented, you know, and I didn't really, that's the energy can sometimes manifest in a group of people, and certain teachers, I feel, in a way, get distracted by it, but they also manifest it. But that teacher awakened in me. I even felt it when I was sitting. She awakened my heart, and it went from this very intellectual approach to seeking, even though I had this deep awakening to begin with, to bringing it into my heart. And I just fell so deeply in love with the teacher. And I, you know, to put this into context, I was the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. I mean, I had no heart. I couldn't even tell my wife, I love you. So that's how dry, you know, and just, you know, I was a sensitive person, but it just wasn't a loving, embracing kind of guy. But that teacher woke up my heart. And interestingly enough, that lasted about 2 years. But it was really, really evident to me that it was time to move on. And I was resisting leaving that teacher, which was another great lesson in this whole spiritual seeking process. You know, we get messages in life with our relationships with other people, our, you know, children, spouses, teachers, jobs. And it was evident to me that I was getting stronger and stronger messages, and I kept resisting leaving this teacher. And finally, the message was so strong that I knew I was done, I was finished, and I had to move on. And so the gifts were all given, the gift basket was empty for that teacher, and I'm grateful. You know, I'm grateful for everything she did and all that happened, but it wasn't all rosy. I will say there were certain things that still, in retrospect, kind of left some wounds that would take time to heal. So, you know, people always think about seeking as some, you know, some people are lopsided into all agony. You know, and some people think, oh, this is going to be all about pleasantries, but it never seems to be one or the other. So that teacher opened my heart, and there was a final teacher who sort of, I went to a retreat, a silent retreat, and I went because I got a scholarship, and I wouldn't have gone because the retreats are really expensive. But there was something about the teacher who was very rose-like. You know, he told stories that were funny. You know, I remember sitting around Rose in tears crying because I was laughing so hard. And this teacher also was kind of put me at ease with his storytelling. But what I would say, in essence, that he did, I had such deep beliefs that were created by the first two teachers who had strong personalities about what enlightenment should be, that this teacher systematically, and not to me, I mean, there were 300 people in this retreat, but for me, I was loving the whole retreat, and just systematically undercut every concept that I had deeply embedded in me about what enlightenment was. And so the last thing, and I recognized that when it was happening, it wasn't like this grand event. You know, a lot of us are waiting in spiritual circles for what I call the grand mall enlightenment. You know, it's going to be this huge cataclysmic thing that happens. But I realized very softly that self-doubt was deeply embedded in me. And so what I had seen in the awakening in 2007 was what I describe is I came back home. So in 2007, you know, I was exposed to my true nature in a very fundamental way. And I went off like a teenager, seeking more, not accepting what was staring me in the face, and that familiar awareness that would still sort of come and go. But at the end of this retreat, I knew when the self-doubt went about that, what was always here, never left me like a lover. It just stuck. I just settled into it, or my mind could no longer deceive me. My thoughts about what enlightenment was, all these grand ideas and concepts that we build, they all fell away. I mean, it's not like there's still stuff there. You know, a good analogy is like a splinter in a finger. You know, there's old patterns and thoughts and things that still have to work their way out. You know, it's like a splinter. It has to work its way out of the skin over time. So I guess what I would describe that whole thing happening is I became everything at that point. And so I became nothing. I fell in love. I became love. I lost my fear of love. I lost my fear of death in the original awakening because I realized that what I am cannot die. And maybe a way of flipping this is I accepted love. I accepted death. And the last thing was, you know, I had this fear of, or aversion, maybe is a better word, to small s self and all these little quirks and things that I was seeing in myself over the last couple of years. And I finally realized that's just self doing its own thing. And by accepting it more, and even this self-doubt is something generated by the self. You know, it's trying to sustain itself with self-doubt. And accepting all that stuff, the fear of self, the aversion of self fell away. And that's kind of what I'm alluding to in the way of everythingness. It's like the true nature merges with everything, including what's happening now all the time, in the relative. You know, there's the opposite of the absolute, although the absolute, you know, it gets hard to describe this to me, that the absolute is sort of has this side of oneness, emptiness, nothingness, but it also has a flip side of the same coin, which is it contains everything relative. And the relative includes this small s self, and the world, the entire world. So I guess the message I would like to say is, you know, that's a story, certainly very unique to me. And this stuff, I remember hearing other people's realizations. The best thing those did for me was inspire me. You know, that made it possible. They kept me going. They intrigued me. They mystified me. But that story is so unique to me that it's really, really not good, I would say, for other people to try to duplicate it or try to grasp, you know, every word that I said. Maybe things would happen in reverse. You know, somebody could open to love. Somebody could be open to everythingness first. I don't know. There's certainly different things for different people wired different ways. But so it doesn't all happen to happen at once. That's the other thing that I'd like to get across, that, you know, this stuff just can take time. And if there's anything I would say a benefit or value to seeking, is that it lays a great groundwork. You know, people want to get to the end of the path as quickly as they can, but this, in my life, what I've seen is this seeking laid a foundation, a great, great, like, structure, that once I realized truly that I don't exist, it wasn't shocking. You know, it wasn't like something that would put me in a nut house. You know, it was when I realized that it was all taken away, then that seeking had left a nice firm place to grab onto. And that's kind of it in a nutshell.
In regards to the question, is there an end to the spiritual path? How would you answer that?
The short answer to your question is no. I don't believe there's an end. There is a part, a part where a person, you know, my message is nowadays, this is in contrast to my seeking days early on, where I pushed hard. Nowadays, my message is to just simplify and recognize that this whole idea of finding something grand is in fact in every person, if they just subtly shifted their attention into their fundamental nature. It's, you know, I'm trying not to be mystical. I want to be practical rather than abstract. If, you know, on a very simplest scale, anything alive, a human being, when they wake up in the morning, they are aware. So there's this very simple side of the equation, which is always present, clear, simple beingness, I amness, awareness. You can call it all those different things. It's what breathes life into us. So it doesn't have to be mysterious. So there's a point where recognizing that quality in ourselves, just shifting the attention very subtly to know that it's there, that's what we are. You know, and some people it could be very dramatic, other people could be a very soft understanding, but it's not an, certainly not knowledge, you know, that it's experiential, but it's always here. So shifting the attention from things outside of us, which I include thoughts, feelings, sensations in the body, you know, things that are not our true nature, if they just shift into that, that to me could be construed as an end, because it's a discovery of our true nature. We become it. We become our true nature, which is always here, unchangeable from anything on the outside. You know, if you want to put this in scientific terms, it could be that consciousness recognizes itself even in the brain. The brain starts to change with this introspection. Meditation starts to rewire itself, and science is really showing this lately in the last 10 years. So maybe when the neural patterns shift into just becoming more adept at recognizing our true nature, just like a sculptor or an artist or somebody who really practices at something, they really fundamentally live in that. That could be an end, but the other side of this is the everythingness. And if you take that very literally, you know, that things are happening in life all the time that test our potential, you know, test our abilities. And to me, all that stuff every day reveals mysteries about me that I didn't know about. So when I come into circumstances, you know, generally they're confrontational, or they almost exclusively involve other people, groups, whatever setting it is, that test me in a way, and I see things about myself that I didn't realize were there. You know, kind of the buzzword today is the shadow stuff, you know, that's buried deep. That to me is never ending. So there's mysteries about life and mysteries about myself that are ongoing. And does it really affect the true nature? No, that stuff doesn't change what's always here, but it's the two merging to me, the relative and the one, the consciousness that we are. That's the beauty of life. That's the miracle. That's the ever unfolding process. And I hope that doesn't sound lofty or mysterious. I'd really, you know, I'd rather bring it down to practical terms. But yeah, so what I would say is it becomes a recognition of what you truly are and what you truly aren't. That's never ending. You know, it's a two-way recognition. And that will continue. And I'm sure there are things about myself tomorrow or the next day or the next year that will be revealed that I had no idea were there. So that'll never end till I die.
You described sitting in the community building and doing a practice of observing your thoughts and really wanting to know the source of those thoughts. And then you, just a moment ago, you mentioned shifting into awareness and how this is, awareness is something that people, each morning when they get up, that awareness is there. What's the difference between what you were doing, your practice of observing, and the shifting into awareness? Are they the same thing? Is there something that you weren't doing in your normal meditative practice years ago that you recognize now? I'm not clear on that.
Yeah, I've thought about that myself. I think in retrospect, I can't believe I fooled myself so deeply. So when I was studying my mind, you know, back there in a community building in the years leading up to that, I think there was a feeling that this awareness was within my control. It felt personal. It felt like I was doing something with it. I feel like I was pushing or trying to do something. And I know I'm gonna run into a paradox here, the whole thing about volition and non-volition, but I was applying myself, and I didn't realize I was applying myself to something that was really, the technique was keeping me from seeing something so simple and so obvious. So I was distracting myself by feeling like I needed to do something to be realized. I'm really struggling with that question, Sean. Because I really do feel the part of the formula is definitely perseverance. And I don't mean pushing so hard, like sitting in a lotus position and pushing so hard that, you know, there will be some cataclysmic thing that will happen as a result of that effort. It's not exactly cause and effect. Because and the reason that makes sense to me is because what we're looking for is always right here, but it's so obvious and so much in plain sight, we can't accept the implications of it being available and accessible all the time. I really feel like our whole evolutionary process is designed, like our brain and everything's designed, and this isn't a bad thing, it's just designed to be outward focused. So we're looking for threats in the environment, you know, certainly deep programming to reproduce and have a family, and it's just not designed to stop and be still with what's always here. So I think there was a second part to that question. Like, what's different about now versus then?
Well, yes, I would be curious to, when you mentioned, sounded like advice to a person these days about shifting into awareness, or that's what's required, is a shift into awareness. I think fundamentally, I'm curious about, well, what are you suggesting to people as a practice, or do you suggest practices to people these days, and how is that different from what you were doing? How is that different from sitting and meditating and observing the mind and observing thoughts? It sounds to me like there is some difference,
yeah.
But I don't know what that is.
Yeah, because I feel it's like to use a term Rose used, it's like an umbilical cord, this watching process. The watching to me is it's building a skill. It's like instead of our attention being directed outward, it's directed inward. And a person can get more skillful at doing that. So it's the watching process that creates a dichotomy. So the dichotomy being what is watched and what is watching. So, you know, there's different terms for the observer, the witness, the watching process. And there's a play that occurs between those two qualities within ourselves. So, you know, his teachings employed the reverse vector, the retreat from error, and those different words, falling away of self, backing away from untruth, unknowing. You know, all these are terms used to just realize that anything that is viewed is really not the viewer. So that's the backing away. It's like the falling away of what is not truth. And the more a person does that, I feel perhaps there's even something going on in the brain where it starts to work this stuff out, even in the background, maybe. You know, we might set aside, every teacher I've been around said, set aside 30 minutes or an hour a day or whatever time period just to be with yourself, let your whole system quiet down and reflect on your what makes you tick, you know, the thoughts, the feelings. And so that process, I feel like it allows something to work in the background, even outside of that time period of quiet, in which we're almost, it's almost like a muscle. We're getting better at watching with time. And it doesn't matter what the content is. So many people get caught up in their thoughts and what tends to happen, I saw this in myself, it tends to get very subtle. And you can really realize that there is a part of you that is trying to manage everything in life. So it's, you know, most people are trying to manage all this stuff in their life outside, thinking that if I just get all this shit in order in my life, I'll be able to be spiritual. The subtle part is then you start to realize I see thoughts and feelings and things that I'm doing that are, quote, non-spiritual or things that I don't like. And it's actually Poyan, who was Rose worked with, and there's, if you Google that term, Poyan, on the internet, you'll find information about him. He had this ego one, ego two play out, and that's what I'm talking about. The manager is a part of us that thinks I should be doing, thinking, feeling something, and another part that is not doing that, not behaving well, and it's like two aspects of self fighting against each other. I'm not talking about that kind of watching, although you can watch those two kind of engage with themselves, but I think that's why I like just the idea of relaxing and letting thoughts arise, letting feelings arise without trying to mess with them, without managing them, especially in meditation. And that includes sensory perceptions, it includes body sensations, just watching and realizing there's a quality of yourself that's always there, and everything else comes and goes. Thoughts, feelings, you know, a bird singing, everything comes and goes. That's the relative. Whereas there's something familiar, and I don't mean to be mystical or mad, you know, talk about magic or whatever about this quality, but it's just this fundamental nature in ourself. And I guess that's, in the end, what's realized, you know, we've been watching all this stuff all this time, trying to look for it, and we are it. We can't be anything else. It is everywhere, and it's almost laughable in a way that, my God, I've been looking for this, and here it's been with me the whole time. So I think I tackled your question, but that watching process is really crucial, and everybody's going to come at this in a different way.
So it sounds to me, to summarize, that before your idea of observation was that you, that there was an observer quality to you, and that you identified with that, like that was Phil was the observer of thoughts and feelings. He was some sort of neutral stance or neutral place from which he could observe those things.
Yeah, and it felt very personal at that point. It felt like it was contained inside of me. It was like I was awareness. I was this piece of awareness, and everything else was outside of me. And all the shift that I'm talking about, the subtle shift, is there's a realization it's totally impersonal. It's totally within all things. It's everywhere. It's just consciousness, and life is the contact between our true nature and the relative. You know, that's what's realized.
Now that shift into awareness, it's certainly a word that I hear a lot. As you know, I'm out here in California, so we're very much about
ground zero
awareness and just noticing, you know, just noticing what's happening and so forth. Which are catchphrases that I often speak of derisively, as somehow people are thinking that just noticing that, oh, I am aware, you know, I am aware of my thoughts. When I wake up in the morning, there's an awareness there, and that's who I really am. Got it? Okay. That makes sense. Is that what you're talking about, or is there? Do you feel like there is some depth that is being missed in that realization? This is something I struggle with a lot, because there are a lot of teachers who point out how simple this is and how we just overlook what's the most obvious thing, and a lot of students who say, oh, okay, yeah, I got it. I see what you mean. Is it as simple as that?
I would say that's the start of it. That simple recognition would be the start of it. And it's really to rest in reality. There would have to be this dual recognition that I mentioned before, which is a recognition of what you are, what you aren't. And this is not a one-off kind of thing. It's not like, oh, I got it. I feel that, as I mentioned before, like this everythingness process, this unfolding, the unfinished part, is the piece of the puzzle that completes it. And so, you know, as I really tried to make it clear in my story, there was a settling into this, and there's still a settling into this deeper aspect of ourselves. It's like there's still beliefs, there's still some beliefs and concepts and thoughts that captivate me and take me away. But so if a person sees the obvious, that they are awareness, but then says, okay, I can get on with my life, if they're not living it, then they're not fully seeing their full potential. And that full potential is to really settle into the fact that their attention now rests in this true nature or awareness or beingness, and much less so in thoughts, being swept away in thoughts. And I don't mean to imply like I'm living, you know, the end goal, and maybe this is the case, you know, I'm not this mystery, which I'm convinced would never be solved, but there's still a mystery to reality to me, but there might be a point where a person rests as awareness, unperturbed by, you know, things that arise in life or within thoughts and feelings. Maybe that's the case, but I suspect that there's definitely a sliding scale there. So, yeah, I think if a person really continues to apply themselves and still just go where their natural state is, keep their attention on this deeper nature within ourselves, this stillness, consciousness, the other stuff, what I call noise of the mind, you know, rather than say ego or make labels, but just say noise of the mind, which is a layer on top of an unnecessary layer that would go on through the day, which is generally the chatter in our mind, the labeling, the blah, blah, blah part of ourselves that's adding these suffering, so to speak. Generally, that's the source of suffering. If it's adding all that stuff through the day, unnecessarily, it's not, there's no value added to the internal chatter, talking to ourselves, they're still being swept away by it. So the more a person just tunes into the broadcast of reality, which is always here, tune less into the static, you know, that's being created by the noise of the mind, I think that's the vector, so to speak. That's where things just continue to unfold. So maybe that's a litmus test. There's still a lot of inner chatter, but they feel like they've got it. Where I say just keep turning the attention to this inner this consciousness, which is always there with them, or awareness.
Is there a danger that turns into a quest to perfect the personality or to become something that's perhaps not possible in this world? I can't tell if you're describing an unperturbed being, you know, who no matter what comes at them acts in a saintly manner, or acts like the Dalai Lama or something like that. You know, and again, I admittedly, I have a goal-oriented bias, if you will, in this stuff of just get me to the end so that I'm done, so that I don't have to practice anymore, and I can just live life and be satisfied with whatever comes up.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way of describing it. What I mentioned before about the aversion to self having these quirky aspects to me, and the flaws that are just part of my character. You know, it's just I was raised a certain way. I grew up in the United States. I have an ethnic background. So there's things about me that are very unique, that are very particularized ray of the absolute. And so, to answer your question about is there a satisfaction with life, that is what happened rather recently for me, that acceptance of all those qualities of myself, small as self. And when there is, you know, I call it the fear of self or the aversion of self, mostly falls away, the satisfaction increases dramatically. So maybe when you were talking, I was thinking, I had this word asymptotic pop up into my head, taking me back to my intellectual days where, you know, it's a steep curve of stuff falling away in the beginning, perhaps, and then it just, like, the curve flattens out, but never really becomes totally flat. You know, just there's still stuff that falls away, but the shift is fundamentally into total satisfaction. I wouldn't say total, but I would say majority of life is satisfying and happy and less about resisting what happens. Not to say it's pleasant, you know, that people can confuse that life is this whole state of enlightenment is about a state of pleasantness or bliss or whatever, but it's more all the stuff gets thrown at us and then we just react to it in a proper way. You know, a good example is if somebody punches me in the face, I'm not going to be, quote, a spiritual being with compassion, you know, and turn the other cheek. You know, I'm going to have a fight or flight reaction to that. But the dissatisfaction that would often come after that event would, for most people, would be reflecting on it. What could I have done differently? And they torture themselves with all this chatter going on internally. And it's totally unnecessary. What's necessary is how to react at the time it occurs, but then letting it go, you know, to it, and that's the satisfaction, that stuff just doesn't stick around as long as it used to.
And the people that you interact with in a teaching role, what are the two or three most common blocks, if you will, that you see to them achieving whatever it is they're after?
I think fears and desires are common. And again, I don't want to be abstract. So, you know, I remember thinking when I listened to teachers and they talked, you know, I've heard teachers say, I have no fears or I have no thoughts. Fears are, going back to what I was saying before, like fears of death, fears of love, fears of, like, and by love, I mean fears of opening up to others, kind of closing ourselves off because we're afraid we'll reveal ourselves. Fears of life and fears about our own human flaws. So that's a fear. That could be construed as a fear of change. You know, there's fear people want, as I said before, they want to control their outer life, they want to control their inner life. So there's fears about things changing that are outside of their control. And you could flip that around very easily with desire. There's desires because they're unhappy with current circumstances, so they're trying to change it. The other big thing is beliefs. And this is just amazing in retrospect. The beliefs that I had about what I should be doing, what enlightenment was. And to a large degree, teachers perpetuate these beliefs, whether I mean, I accept responsibility for forming the beliefs, but I think the teachers perpetuate beliefs either overtly or totally innocently by talking about the state that they're in. And often I feel like this, what they're talking about is so unique to them. And a good example, a practical example, was somebody who's a total mess, you know, is deeply, deeply suffering. You know, it's like a donkey carrying 100 pounds of baggage, all this stuff in their lives, their traumas and conditionings and just things that they're carrying around with them. If 90 pounds of the 100 pounds were to drop off, they would feel ecstatic. You know, this is like, ah, my God, I'm relieved of those burdens and those things that I had been carrying around, the deep beliefs about stuff. But somebody who was carrying 20 pounds of baggage, you know, I would put myself in that camp in a way. A lot of my baggage was spiritual seeking suffering as opposed to traumas in my childhood or whatnot. But if I lost 10 pounds, 10 pounds of that 20, then I would be, that's better. But so somebody teaching from the standpoint of the first person deeply suffering is going to have a totally different message and convey that. And so then the students or the people listening start to believe that's what it's all about. You know, that, and they start to try to behave in the way the teacher's describing. They start to expect certain things to happen. So beliefs are an enormous, enormous block. And that's this process of looking that I mentioned before, the watching. It's not just thoughts and feelings. It's like, what do I believe light enlightenment is? What is this? What is this I'm looking for? You know, and there's I could go on. There's just a lot of things that I expected it to all be, and none of it was none of it was true or anything I could have even imagined.
Now, you offer retreats occasionally. Can you tell me a little bit about what happens at these retreats? What are you having dialogues with people or sitting in meditation? What style of retreat do you offer?
I'd say a big part of it is to create an atmosphere of friendship, whether it's the friendship occurs there at the retreat, and it often does. You know, there's some people know each other, but generally it's a group thrown together, and you know, we're talking 8 to 12 people, so it's a small group environment. And that friendship is expressed in a couple of different ways. So what I've gravitated to lately was having large chunks of silent periods for people to reflect inward, but also mixing that up in people sharing about themselves in an informal way, like over meals, and then also creating space in the retreat for people to share openly with others what they're experiencing. And you know, a big thing for me going back to when I was 20 is what I call rapport. So we call this rapport retreats, and rapport means in harmony with. That's the way I use it. You know, Richard Rose had a different style of rapport. You know, the Quakers have a style of rapport of sitting in silence as a group. Our rapport is to be in harmony with our fellows in a very deeper way, very much deeper way than we would in casual conversation. So sitting in silence for a certain period and with some guide, you know, some guidance, which I've refined more and more as I sit myself. What I advocate to most people, whether we're sitting in a group or sitting by ourselves, is just to be open to what's happening. You know, I think I'm certain there's certain styles of meditation going way back for centuries and are even practiced today. I'm not very versed in all those different styles of teachings, but this probably is close to some of the ones that are common today, but it's very much opening up to what's happening as we sit. So just allowing thoughts, feelings, sounds, other perceptions, body sensations, just let it be, relax, and find out what makes us tick in the hopes that by some accident we'll actually realize this fundamental part of ourselves, which is just always there, this awareness. And I feel like the sitting with the same intent, there's something magical about that that magnifies that stillness or that core part of ourselves over the mind's noise. It somehow like kind of shifts the emphasis into that core nature, that awareness over the noise. So that sitting together as a group, we get in harmony with each other. We get in harmony more with our smallest self. You know, if you let thoughts and feelings and stuff come and go, you realize that isn't what you really are. And we can become in harmony with capital S self, our true nature. You know, so that's why we call these rapport retreats. They opened my heart. I really, really just bond with people deeply. I'm not a teacher, so I don't go in there with the attitude that I have something that you don't. I more or less facilitate it. It's more like I'm their peers as we go through the weekend. Yeah, that's kind of the description in a nutshell. It creates a really nice environment, and I hope it, when people leave, they continue their friendship and work with each other outside of the retreats and have a sense of community with that, you know, and something deeper continues to call within after the retreat is over.
Do you give any recommendations after the retreat is over, or things that people could do on their own?
I think people would do well to gravitate to setting aside some time. You know, I think what we do in the retreat carries over very nicely to being alone and setting aside some time every day to do this quiet introspection. Not with the goal of creating some kind of blissful state or any state. It's the reverse, actually, to just be comfortable with everything that's changing in our lives. And I just think probably one thing that I'm open to, it's happened after some of the retreats, is to Skype with people one-on-one. I really still dislike being the center of attention. So I really appreciate some people who can teach. You know, they have the gift of gab. And, you know, I'm the most boring, monotone, ordinary kind of guy. So for me to get up and be this dynamic speaker and deliver these 1-2 punches to people, that's just not going to happen in a large group. I'm just not going. I probably, if I applied myself, I could stumble my way into it and be a bit better at it. But yeah, I find that one-on-one conversations, small group retreats, Skyping is where I'm probably especially adept at just working with some people. And again, as a peer, you know, I really emphasize this ordinary quality within us all. We're all on the same playing field, so to speak, when it comes to our true nature and just getting people to simplify. That's the big message, to simplify into the ordinary qualities.
Are there any particular books that you recommend these days?
I'll use my shotgun approach. hoping that one of the BBs, I think this is your analogy, that one of the BBs hits somebody. So probably on a wide spectrum, I would certainly recommend Richard Rose's Psychology, The Observer. And I would recommend people pay particular attention to how he lays out this Jacob's ladder in there, in the body, mind, essence, and you know, and I think it's in that book, it might be in the Direct Mind Experience, but the idea of paradox, because it just, I think what tends to happen in our beliefs is we get latched into one side of the spectrum or another, you know, and to give you an example, that nothingness versus everythingness, some people can get too hung up on either of those, where Rose really conveys in that Direct Mind Experience, or maybe Psychology Observer, this idea of a conciliatory principle and being comfortable with everything in between everythingness and nothingness. You know, that's a quote from Nisargadatta: my life flows between nothingness and everythingness, between love and emptiness. So those two books are good, especially for somebody who's a bit more intellectual. You know, I would say for somebody who has been on the path for a while, I just read just a very ordinary book. Probably I'm recommending this because it's recent and I just met the guy. Don Oakley, O-A-K-L-E-Y. And it's, I think it's Wake Up Now, and it's the 10 Common Myths of Spiritual Seeking. I'm butchering the title. But he just released it. And why I recommend that is because those that have been on the path for a while don't need any more advice. They actually need to undercut all the stuff that they've built up over the years, the beliefs. And that's why he tackles the 10 common myths that people have about spiritual seeking and what it takes to be, quote, enlightened. I certainly love the classics, I Am That. I recommend, if anybody has it on their bookshelf, to pull that out about every 2 or 3 years and marvel at how much more is revealed. If you really want to gauge your sense of progress on a path, that might be one way to do it. Like, pull that off the shelf every 2 or 3 years and you'll see stuff in that book that you hadn't seen in the last pass. I find things that, you know, when I experienced love, I didn't even see the word love in that book, but once I experienced it, love was weaved all through it. That's just one example. All the Tap Foundation books, and this isn't my marketing hat, but what I like about it is, again, it depersonalizes it. That's the trap we get ourselves into. When somebody finds, they get very much hooked into forming a belief around that teacher and what they're trying to convey. Where all those books in Tap Foundation Press are from different teachers, and they all will resonate in different ways with different people. And they certainly depersonalize the whole experience of what it is to see reality or be reality. I've lately gravitated to some of the books just because of my scientific inclinations. There's some books out on kind of what's happening in the brain. And I'm not very helpful. I'm actually reading the book now and I can't remember the title of it. But what I like about it is he strips out all the religious qualities of it, all the mystical sides, and says, you know, these are the things happening in the brain. It's rewiring.
Yeah, well, if you send me the title later, I can add it to, I'll have some show notes.
Okay.
With this, and we can just add it in there.
Great. Yeah, I can do that.
And how about films? That's, I don't think that's something I've ever heard you talk much about. Are there any films or videos that you think maybe capture some of the the feeling that you try to convey?
Well, of course, the number one film would be Closer Than Close.
I've never heard of that.
It's very obscure, yes. I'm not one to go to the movies for spiritual inclinations, but I do. All my life, I've gravitated to science fiction. There's something about the message carried in some science fiction movies that are there's you know, the layers there. One for a large chunk of the audience of entertainment. And there's a deeper layer about more, something deeper in life that's carried in the message of science fiction. But I don't really have any specific titles that I recall. Just lots. I've always loved watching those, even as a teenager.
How's your experience of being in relationship with other people changed? Especially if it's true that, well, there aren't really other people here.
In a word, dramatically. Oh my gosh. It's a little hard to separate natural maturing. So, geez, I think everybody goes through huge changes in how they relate to people. You know, as I said, I'm 53. You think back to when I was 20 and I mentioned how introverted I was and how uncomfortable I was in my own skin. And especially when I'd be around people. There's a huge, and I don't want to overplay this word, but there's much, much more compassion. Doesn't mean I tolerate everyone perfectly well. You know, it's like when I get around people that certain personality characteristics that rub me. I'm not sitting there feeling this warm compassion for everybody, but there's no doubt that that's flipped into a deeper compassion. I take joy in helping people in this spiritual endeavor, especially without asking for anything. I feel like that's a huge key, not to ask anything at all in return, other than, you know, a thank you is enough. But even Rose said, don't thank me, pass it on. That would be my greatest wish too, that somebody who's been helped could pass it on. So I enjoy just doing it without imposing anything on them or requesting anything from them. I am much more open. So I used to hide things about myself. I'm laughing because one of the things that came up, I talked about that partying in college, you know, and when I get around Richard Rose, I would always hide the fact, you know, I would never wear a shirt that said Budweiser on it or anything like that to convey that, you know, I liked drinking. So I don't really have anything that private in my life nowadays that I'm not willing to share, except I won't share it on the internet, you know, obviously. But yeah, you get me at a tap meeting or in a Skype session and people ask me questions, I'm just pretty much fully honest, as long as it doesn't get into something like weirdly personal. But yeah, I'm much more open with people.
And if someone wanted to get in touch with you, what's the best way to go about that?
Well, come to a tap meeting. It seems like I'm putting
a link to that.
Honestly, I am at just about every tap meeting. You know, I'm available by email, but email does have its merits because it causes people, when they're responding back and forth, to really think about it. So it can't be something spontaneous that they would say. So they have to do a little bit of introspection. But I find it it's a lot of work for me as well to put all my thoughts in the email. So Skyping is pretty cool. That works well. And but I guess going back to how they would reach me, that's there's my website, searchwithin.org, which is all about making information available from many, many different teachings, many different finders. There's a lot of Richard Rose material. I have a few essays there, but the idea was just to compile information where people could go to as a one-stop shop and hopefully find things that are very rare and hard to find nowadays. And yeah, my contact information is on there too. It's the webmaster address.
Okay. And I think this may be the last question. What guides you through life?
I would say there's like a foundation that has been built as a result of spiritual work. There is certainly a gravitation to simplifying in all aspects of my life. So when I see things getting too complex, my reaction is to simplify. And I mean by that, my finances, you know, my family life, my interactions with other people, even in the spiritual side. So simplicity is something I move towards without getting too carried away with it, because you know a person can get totally reclusive and oversimplified by just running from life, running from other people. So there's a balance there. And you know, this sounds kind of odd, but I would say remembering. The mind has this amazing ability to forget. In a way, I think it wants to forget this simplified true nature, and just there's discomfort with resting in it. I think that's the nature of the mind and the self. So just remembering through the day that, and just being with what's here. And that stillness, awareness, just remembering to go back to that is really important to me. And lastly, yeah, what's really become more common in my day, like thoughts that come up, is I am just completely amazed and grateful, despite all the blood, sweat, and tears of life and the spiritual seeking and whatnot. If I had just gotten out of the way sooner, probably things would have happened more quickly. So despite all the things that have happened in the past, the gifts far, far outweigh what it's been, you know, some heartache and headache along the way. So yeah, there's like this more and more tuning into the deep gratitude that's in my life and many different things, and realizing how fragile life is, just being grateful for everything that we all have and everything that I have.
Thank you, Phil.
Oh, that's great, Sean. It was really nice to have this conversation. I've never done it before.
Yeah, I appreciate it a lot. It took a couple hours of your day, and I really appreciate it.